Maureen Dowd is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the New York Times and a best-selling author. Her new book, The Year of Voting Dangerously, takes on the most bizarre, disruptive, and divisive presidential race in modern history. In this perilous and often shocking campaign season, Maureen Dowd traces the psychologies and pathologies in one of the nastiest and most significant battles of the sexes ever. Dowd has covered Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton since the 90s. She was with the real estate mogul when he shyly approached his first presidential rope line in 1999, and she won a Pulitzer Prize that same year for her columns on the Clinton impeachment follies. Again, the name of the new book is The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thanks, Joe.
Very nice to have you on the program. When did you start to think that this election was getting dangerous, was getting out of hand?
Well, I didn't think that there would ever be as exciting an election as 2008. I went on the road with that for 2 years because it had gender, it had race issues, it had a young, handsome African-American prince challenging the queen of the Democratic Party, like in Game of Thrones. I mean, it just had everything. So I wasn't hoping, you know, I've gone through so many campaigns where they were really painful to cover. For instance, Bob Dole's, although Bob Dole is a very witty guy, he, you know, his campaign was kind of deadly, and Michael Dukakis's. And one time I said to Michael Dukakis, well, what do you do for fun? And he said, black mulch. And I said, what do you do with the black mulch? And he goes, I put it on my tomato plants. So just imagine a year of that.
Right.
So this time I thought it was going to be this very, for me, repetitive battle between the two dynasties, the Bush dynasty and the Clinton dynasty. And I really wasn't looking forward to it because they have passed the crown back and forth. One of the, or the other of them, have been in office for 28 years. And if Hillary were to win two terms, you know, they would be in office for 36 years. So just from a writer's point of view, it didn't seem like it was going to be very scintillating. So, you know, then Donald Trump and Melania came down the golden escalator, and I call it the escalator to hell, like the Nirvana song, and everything changed in that instant.
You have a line in the introduction of the book that talks about, you know, how obviously through all of the political coverage that you have done in your life, you could become jaded. But you say, then America got mad and went mad. How do you think we, as a people, and even you as part of the press corps, underestimated just how angry Americans are and were?
Yeah, I have essays from my conservative siblings, my brother and sister, in the book. So I think, you know, and also I work in Washington. So I could see, I was covering Ted Cruz's Thunderdome, where he was trying to burn down the Capitol he worked in. And the Republicans promised people a lot of things. They were going to get rid of Obamacare. They were going to fix immigration. They were going to fix the budget process. And they didn't do any of that. And people, Republicans, were getting angry about that. So, you know, I will say this. People think that Trump voters, you know, Hillary called it, this is what I call my family now, a basket of deplorables. But yes, you know, there's a lot of sexism and racism obviously stirred up, and the primal scream of the angry white male who's losing primacy in this country. But also, I think that a lot of Americans have a right to be mad because our economy almost collapsed, and most Americans didn't even know what derivatives were. And we've gone into these 13-year wars that we can't get out of, and we can't win. And most Americans don't know anything about the tribal battle of Sunnis and Shias. And you know, globalization, this bright, shiny thing that was supposed to help America, has not turned out that way for a segment of America. So I do think, you know, my fellow columnists keep going on these Margaret Mead road trips to find these strange creatures called Trump voters and reason with them. And one wrote an open letter and said, I want to meet one of you and reason, but all I have to do is go home, you know. And I just would like to say there are good reasons why people should be angry.
What is interesting about that, though, sure, there are reasons to be angry, and yet through the process that would nominate the candidates to fix that anger, we have chosen two of the most unpopular candidates, according to the polls, in recent memory. And it's hard, if you extrapolate that data, to believe that they are capable of making those very mad voters happy.
Yes. You know, I think the problem is that the parties are so weak now. So sometimes I think, well, why can't the Republicans have a candidate like Jim Comey? You know, I've gone to some of his speeches. He's a really smart guy, really counterintuitive thinker. He stood up to the Bush administration on torture. You know, he looks like a classic kind of Henry Fonda type of candidate. That's who you'd think the Republicans would pick. But when I say that to people, they remind me that the parties don't really exist anymore. So there aren't any smoke-filled rooms where people get picked. There isn't even any smoke anymore.
Maureen Dowd is our guest. The name of the book is The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. In writing about these candidates, I'm curious for you to give us the origin story. How did you meet each candidate and start your journalistic relationship with each?
I met Donald Trump in the late 90s. In 99, he went out on a presidential exploratory bid. And it was just a lark, you know, he didn't think he was going to run and I didn't, but I figured it would make a fun feature. So we went to Miami and he gave a speech to Cuban Americans and we went on his plane, which was filled with guilt, obviously, and a double bed and French Impressionist paintings, which were fake because they couldn't take the altitude, obviously. And he approached the rope line, and he was very shy about it. You know, he kind of scampered away, and that was that. And then I just would check in with him over the years and kind of do an interview, at just a lightning round of who was in the news. And Hillary, I met when she was running as the wife of Bill Clinton in 92, and we went to a revolving restaurant in Kentucky, and we had white wine, and we ate dinner. And everyone always says she's very charming and fun in private, and she was. And we talked about a summer job she had in Alaska when she was at Yale Law School, where she was sliming fish. And she looked at the fish, and they looked old to her. They looked purple and black and yucky looking. So she went to the owner and said, these fish don't look right. And he said, I want you to keep quiet about that. And she said no and quit. And that's the great public servant side of Hillary Clinton. You know, no one doubts that she's tough and she wants to make the world a better place. You know, she just sometimes, I think, makes decisions from a place of insecurity and fear.
So that idea of decisions from insecurity and fear, does that come from years of, in her mind, being burned? Or do you think that it's more primal in who she is?
That's a great question. You know, and I spent this past weekend reading my book, which traces her narrative arc, and other Hillary biographies and trying to figure out the answer to that. And, you know, when she was at Wellesley, she was kind of a pure idealist. And then I think when she moved to Arkansas, maybe she got a hard time for she kept her maiden name and the press was upset. She wasn't Mrs. Bill Clinton, but she still was not really as paranoid as she later became. When she got to Washington, and, you know, they went through a series of scandals like Whitewater and Travelgate and things like that. And that's when she began to build her wall against the press. And she was very secretive and defensive. And George Stephanopoulos said in the Carl Bernstein biography, if he could evoke a magic genie and do anything differently about his time with the Clintons, he would have tried to force Hillary to give the Whitewater papers to the Washington Post, because he thinks then the story would have been over in a week. And instead, because they were so secretive and defensive and people thought they were hiding something, it cascaded into impeachment and like seven independent counsels and $80 million in taxpayers' money when, you know, it didn't need to do that. And you saw that same pattern with her health scare last week, where, as David Axelrod said, it was really about the stealth more than the health. I mean, of course, you're going to get sick if you're a candidate. There's nothing wrong with that. But you've just level with people.
Maureen Dowd is our guest. The name of the new book is The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. When you look at the unpopularity of both candidates, on paper, does it make sense that, I mean, you hear the phrase lesser of two evils a lot. And I guess I'm interested in that idea of, when you look at it on paper, does it seem like he would be more ultimately unlikable than her?
That's really interesting. Well, because you're a New Yorker, do you remember when Murray Kempton used to use the phrase, the evil of the lesser of two evils?
Yes.
That's what voters are kind of scared and depressed and, as Peggy Noonan said, veering between anxiety over Trump and depression over Hillary. And people are voting against the candidates rather than for them. And that's what makes this sort of a dispiriting election. And, you know, I've been interviewing a lot of Trump's. He doesn't have that many close friends, but I've been interviewing them lately for a magazine piece. And, you know, they say that he is not the guy we're seeing on the trail, that behind, you know, the guy they know is a charming, fun guy. So this is what's weird about this race. You know, these two people are two of the most famous people on the planet. And yet we don't really know who they are. In my book, I quote from a memo that Hillary's staff sent her back in 92, where they say, this week, we're going to introduce the real Hillary. We're going to reintroduce you and show people the real Hillary. Well, it's a quarter of a century later, and they're saying the exact same thing this week. This week, they're going to reintroduce Hillary and show the real Hillary. And in the case of Trump, you know, it's kind of a Janus face thing where is he the white rapper, bling king, bon vivant in New York that he liberal that he used to be, or is he this alt-right, anti-abortion, pro-gun kind of very conservative, bigoted guy he has been in this campaign season? So there are these super famous people, but we're trying to figure out who they are.
In figuring out who they are brings us to the question of, and this has certainly been brought up many times during the campaign and obviously will continue to be brought up, as to who is more fit to be president. And this idea, certainly coming from the left, certainly coming from President Obama and others, who say, here is a man who simply is not fit to be president of the United States. Do you see it that starkly?
Okay, this is a little bit nihilistic, but when I hear the word qualification, it's hard for me, because who had more and longer qualifications than Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld? So, or Nixon, you know, who kind of went crazy in office because of a paranoid streak. But on the other hand, Donald Trump has clinical narcissism at such a level that he doesn't have any ideology. It's just his ego. So you see him with Vladimir Putin, And because he thinks Putin complimented him, he has changed the whole tradition and ideology of the Republican Party toward Putin and Russia to match the fact that he likes Putin because he thinks Putin likes him. It's like a grade school, you know, thing. He likes me, I like him. And so that's now the Republican Party policy. They're all twisting and turning like pretzels to try and back him up on that. It's absurd because they've got a nominee who's cozying up to the evil empire. That's one of the things that's backwards. Then the Democrats have a nominee who's cozying up to Goldman Sachs, you know. So anyway, so Trump, you know, has reduced or subjugated the entire policy part of the Republicans to his own ego. So that is a really crazy situation. But, you know, Joe, in Arthur Schlesinger's memoirs, he pointed out that a lot of modern presidents have been, you know, had problems or been seen as mentally imbalanced. I mean, JFK and Nixon had psychotropic drugs in the cabinet, and LBJ's aides used to argue about whether he was manic depressive or paranoid. And so maybe Trump should just have as a campaign slogan, "I'm already insane, you're going to save time," because presidents seem to go insane a lot anyway.
Okay, but that doesn't even get into the part of what he has said on the campaign trail of banning Muslims and about Mexicans and about the disabled. I mean, there's some very concerning red flags here, aren't there?
Yes, he's been like a total bigot. But the Republican Party is very hypocritical because they have used homophobia and misogyny and racism for a long time since Nixon's Southern Strategy, but they just prefer a more subtle form of racism.
So when we get to back to that idea of being fit, if you have a person who arguably, Hillary Clinton, who arguably is a politician being a politician, is that different than someone like Donald Trump who has these bigoted racist tendencies that seem to be alarming and moving even us in the under the guise of being politically correct, of normalizing that behavior, especially when, as you look at the polls, half the nation seems to approve of it?
Well, you know, Donald Trump will signal you that he's not really this person we're seeing on stage, you know, that he would be a president that the New York Times would approve of, that he's flexible. So, in other words, these are just negotiating bids. But as you say, you are who you are at the microphone. And he said these things. And if little Muslim kids are going to be beat up or Muslim women, then he is a bigot and a racist because he has said this stuff. It doesn't really matter if he sees it. I think he thinks of himself as a salesman. And in the moment, he's trying to make the sale. And, you know, like a real estate salesman, he will exaggerate and do what he has to make the sale. But, you know, once you do that, that's who you are.
You write in the book, and I thought this was an interesting thing to put in this book, about Saturday Night Live. You interview Lorne Michaels, you interview Kate McKinnon, who has portrayed Hillary Clinton, and it gives us an idea of how these candidates and how specifically Hillary Clinton, but both candidates, can be parodied and satired. I'm curious as to give us a sense of what that experience was like and ultimately why you wanted to even explore it.
Lorne Michaels is one of the most charming people I've ever met. I did a Vanity Fair cover on Tina Fey when she was portraying Sarah Palin, and I got to know him a little, and I've met him over the years. And he has an amazing kind of colorful background in TV and a very wise, interesting take on things. And so I just thought it would be fun because remember when Tom Wolfe was writing Bonfire of the Vanities and the satire would get ahead of him so that he could not write as fast as the crazy things were happening in New York City? And so it's a little bit like that. So I did a satire on what it must have been like when Donald Trump had his first meeting with Paul Ryan. And I did it as a satire from my column. And then I called and interviewed Donald Trump. And so the next week, I was going to do the actual meeting. But it was so much like my fake funny meeting that I had to just lead the column with, this is not a satire. Because what I had imagined happening with Paul Ryan, the awkwardness and the craziness of turning over the Republican Party to this 70-year-old high chair king, had actually happened. So it is a little bit beyond parody.
In talking to Kate McKinnon, who has wonderfully portrayed Hillary Clinton on Saturday Night Live, what did you get from that conversation?
Yeah, I went up to see her on the set of Ghostbusters. And she's very, you know, she plays a character called the Cat Lady. And she herself is very feline. She's beautiful. She's the first openly lesbian cast member of Saturday Night Live. She's beautiful and sexy. And I think it's hard for her to play, you know, Hillary for laughs and make fun of her because she's a huge Hillary supporter. And when I interviewed Tina Fey about Sarah Palin, you know, that was hard for her because she came from a Republican family and her parents wanted her to get tickets for Palin rallies. But mostly Tina Fey did not want to affect the election by making Palin either more appealing or less appealing. And that's why she wouldn't appear in a skit actually on stage with her. They just walked past each other. Because what Lorne said, which is amazing, is he thinks Will Ferrell's portrayal of W actually helped W win the 2000 race. Because even though he came across as sort of stupid in the portrayal, he seemed benign and sort of lovable because it was Will Ferrell. So Lorne does think that Saturday Night Live changed that race.
Maureen Dowd is our guest. The name of the new book is The Year of Voting Dangerously: The Derangement of American Politics. You do have a section in the book entitled Meanwhile on Planet Vulcan, and you look at President Obama, and of course, with just a few months left in his administration, we look at his legacy. Through the lens of this campaign, how do you think this president comes out looking?
Well, it's interesting. You can see him raring at the bit to get at Trump and making the case against him. And I went to Cuba with President Obama and his family when they went down there recently. And, you know, you have to be, when you travel with him abroad, very proud of him as a president because he's very elegant and smart and his family is perfection. His numbers have been going up because he's so classy compared to Trump being so vulgar. And he has no shadows compared to the Clintons. There's always some mishigas with the Clintons. They're always, you know, the foundation and the email server, they're just kind of shading the truth and blurring the lines. So everyone in the last 8 years has gotten used to Obama not doing that. So his numbers keep going up. I would only just say that my only criticism of President Obama is that he likes to stay above the fray. And politics is the fray. So you almost feel, James Carville said to me, and it's in the book, you know, it's as though Peyton Manning didn't like football. He accomplished this amazing thing. He didn't have a rich daddy. He's the first African-American president at such a young age with barely any Senate experience. And yet, you know, he doesn't seem to like politics very much. He didn't really want to apply any elbow grease with Congress. So that is the arc of the Obama section.
Is that a detriment, though? I mean, given where we are in politics, and of course it can be argued that if he had done that, that more could have been accomplished in Congress. But also, it seems to be a little refreshing to see someone who is wary of the office, of what it has become.
He has a complete right to, you know, think Congress, he, tr- treated him badly. They were completely obstructionist. They were plotting from the beginning to, you know, obstruct him. But on the other hand, even Leon Panetta, you know, who was a Clinton official, said he just would have liked to see him roll up his sleeves more and use a little elbow grease, because there were certain things, the gun control bill, that he could have done if he had been willing to wheel and deal. And when you see, you know, they've been playing on American experience, all the biographies of presidents, and when you see LBJ kind of wheeling and dealing, you just think, if only Obama had added that to his magical Luke Skywalker kind of persona, that would have been a dynamite combination.
In covering this race and in the book, I'm curious as to what your thoughts are on racism and the Obama legacy, as well as sexism in this particular campaign.
Well, it's interesting because President Obama, you know, I went on the road with him and he would never say anything was racist. And I think that's a good template, because Hillary this time around has been calling a lot of things sexist. And I think it's better, even if they are racist and sexist, not to, for the principal, not to bring that up. It's just a better way to do it, I think. I mean, when I watch Trump rallies on YouTube and see the scroll of comments next to the rally, it is so breathtakingly sexist and sometimes racist that it makes me want to go sign up for Hillary's campaign. But then I snap out of it because I'm a journalist. And, you know, of course, having the first African-American president and the first woman on a major party ticket has stirred up a lot of that. But I think that Obama set a good example that Hillary should follow, just not to bring it up.
Not to bring it up, do you think, if she becomes president, or do you believe even now, because it does seem like there has to be a distinction made, especially when you have a candidate, as you have already described, as vulgar?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's interesting with Hillary, because ordinarily you would have thought that with the first woman, the question would be, is she tough enough? But that question never arises. Everyone knows Hillary is tough enough. But usually with women politicians, they have something called a virtue advantage. And Hillary does not have that, because people think, you know, that she kind of dissembles on things like the emails. And so she loses the virtue advantage. But on the other hand, as a woman, she doesn't have to prove she's tough enough. Unfortunately, she was trying to prove that with her vote on the Iraq War. And that is probably what caused her to lose in 2008.
If you look at the same comments that you were referring to a moment ago in regards to your work when you appear and for this book and for other things, that the case is often made that you are criticized for being, again, the criticism being unfair to Hillary Clinton. And I wonder if that just is a result of sexism as well.
Well, I think that when a woman writes critically about another woman, I think we still have that catfight thing in mind, you know, from Seinfeld. That still exists in society. And also, I write for a paper that is known as a liberal paper, so people think, you know, I should be on her side. And I think it's hard sometimes for Times readers, because I don't have an ideological column, and every other column is either from the left or the right. So I am not writing from the left or the right. I'm just trying to be what, you know, Plato said every society should have a watchdog. So I'm trying to be that. So I don't think I'm being cruel to Hillary when I write that it's a mistake for her to have had this private server that exposed classified information and that she was paranoid. I mean, her own administration said the same thing. So basically, I'm just trying to say what I see and think, which was that it was careless, which Comey agreed on. And I, you know, then I said, well, the foundation it has too many blurred lines on it. And now they've agreed because they have said that, you know, she wouldn't be part of the foundation if she's elected. And even Democrats, Jill Abramson, our former executive editor, who, you know, has written many positive Hillary columns. She really is a Hillary supporter, did a column a couple of days ago and said Hillary has to be more transparent. She has to put out her Goldman Sachs speeches. She has to get out of the foundation, and so does Chelsea. And, you know, she has to put out more health information. So I don't think it's just me. I think other Democrats complain that Hillary doesn't seem to learn her lesson on transparency as well.
Maureen Dowd is our guest. The name of the new book is The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. So meanwhile, you have journalistic institutions like The Washington Post who have front page editorials on why they believe, and this was in July, of why they believe that Donald Trump should not be the president of the United States and is not fit. So my question to you is, I understand your position of wanting to be the watchdog. Is that ever challenging to you, though, given the vulgarness and given the extreme nature of the Trump campaign? Does that ever become a challenge to you to hold that line as a watchdog?
Oh, I've asked Donald Trump a lot of tough questions. I asked him if it was true, you know, what Marlon Maples told people and in the Ivana divorce papers, that he kept a book by Hitler on his bed. I asked him how he could criticize Bill Clinton for infidelity when he had this famous infidelity with Marlon Maples. I asked him if he had ever had a girlfriend where he had to pay for an abortion after he said that women should be punished for abortion and not men. And with Hillary, I think just because there are a lot of things to reproach Donald Trump for, it doesn't mean that she should be above reproach. That's not healthy for her or us or the democracy.
Is it possible for you, since so many of us have gotten so many aspects of this campaign wrong, to even predict of what the next few weeks are going to be like and how this is going to end up?
Yeah, I don't really predict. I try to report just because I spent 20 years as a political reporter, so that's what I tried to do. But, you know, you can sort of envision that these debates that are coming up, Donald Trump is going to try and portray her as having a health problem, probably. You know, he could, like, shake hands with her at the beginning and then pull out his industrial strength hand sanitizer, do something crazy. And her team has actually gotten psychologists aboard, that's a true thing, to try and figure out how to make him seem crazy. And I'm sure they're trying to plot out a moment like in A Few Good Men where Jack Nicholson goes nuts about, you know, you want us on that wall, where they're going to try and get something out of him that's embarrassing and crazy. So that's, the debates are going to be really important.
Do you think we are making too much out of them? I mean, it seems to be that all eyes are on, especially that first debate. Do you think that given, and I've seen this, and I don't know whether how you feel about it, of that what we saw in the Matt Lauer Commander-in-Chief Forum gives us an idea that both of these candidates are very good at maneuvering around the questions?
Yes, that's why I think that, you know, they set that up as a kind of a celebrity entertainment thing, a showcase for Matt Lauer. But I think with these two candidates, because they have a fluid relationship with the truth, Donald Trump more so because he uses wishful thinking a lot, I think you've got to have people who can really fact check in real time. They should have had Chuck Todd as the moderator of that debate.
Well, the name of the book is The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. In the end, day to day, do you enjoy this? Do you enjoy covering this race?
It's a remarkable race. You know, Donald Trump has gone to a lot of dark places, and covering Hillary Clinton is hard for the reasons you mentioned. I mean, It's hard to explain to people that I think it's good for her. If she blurs lines, it's good for that to be pointed out. So those things are hard. But, you know, it is an amazingly important race. So it's kind of a privilege to be able to write about it for The New York Times.
The name of the book, The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. Maureen Dowd, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Again, Maureen Dowd's latest book is The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. The book is published by 12. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.